Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. And as you all know, it all gets back to not just the economy, but the plain dollars and cents. And Trevor Kobald from Save Our Schools up in Canberra has got his eyes set on the Victorian election later this year, but also on the budget, which has just come down. So let's, with no more ado, go to Andy and see what Trevor has to say about the Victorian budget. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Victorian budget must fix public school funding crisis. These are the key points of a new brief on the state of school funding in Victoria. The full paper can be downloaded from Save Our Schools. Victorian public schools face a funding crisis that must be addressed in the forthcoming Victorian government budget. Public schools are massively underfunded and have been since the Gonski funding model was introduced in 2014 to ensure they are fully funded at the Schooling Resource Standard, SRS. In 2026, Victoria's public schools are only funded at 86% of their SRS. Total underfunding is estimated at $2.2 billion. Public schools are underfunded because of underfunding by both the Commonwealth and Victorian governments, and because of accounting tricks used by the Victorian government to defraud public schools. Public schools in Victoria have far fewer total resources than Catholic and independent schools, even though they enrol the vast majority of low-income and Indigenous students. Overgenerous government funding for private schools is a key factor behind their resource advantage. Updated official funding figures show that the total income per student in Victorian public schools in 2024 was $19,150, compared to $31,005 per student in independent schools and $22,432 in Catholic schools. Commonwealth and Victorian government funding increases for private schools has outstripped that for public schools. Between 2009 and 2024, combined government funding adjusted for inflation increased in Catholic schools by $3,406 per student and by $3,086 for independent schools, compared to $2,362 for public schools. The percentage increase for private schools was double that of public schools. Government funding for Catholic schools increased by 47% and by 57% for independent schools, compared to 25% for public schools. Victoria is the national laggard in the funding of public schools. Unlike every other state and territory government, it refuses to sign a long-term funding agreement with the Commonwealth. Funding in 2026 remains stuck at the 2023 level of 86% of the SRS, the lowest of any state or territory except the Northern Territory. Progress towards fully funding public schools has been glacial under the Victorian Labor government. It has only increased from 81% in 2014 to 86% in 2026, allowing for the accounting tricks introduced in the Morrison-era funding agreements in 2019. The increase of only 5 percentage points over 12 years shows a disgraceful neglect of public schools. By contrast, Victorian Catholic schools are funded at 101% of their SRS in 2026, and independent schools are funded at 102% of their SRS. If Victoria is to live up to its claim to be the education state, it must stop being the national laggard in funding public schools and become the national standard bearer in school funding. It should sign a new funding agreement with the Commonwealth Government to fully fund public schools by 2029. The agreement should provide for the Victorian Government to increase its funding share for public schools to 75% of their SRS, the Victorian Government to immediately end the accounting tricks that defraud public schools, and the Commonwealth to increase its funding share to 25%. Back to you, Jane.
Many thanks, Andy. And as our listeners know, in the past weeks we've been talking about the teachers and the strike in March, but also the possible strike this term as well. There's a statement that's recently come in from the AEU President, Victorian Branch. Here's Dale to tell you about it.
Thanks, Jean. Statement from AEU Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly regarding negotiations for public school staff pay and conditions. The Australian Education Union Victorian branch has achieved strong progress in negotiations towards delivering pay increases aligned with other states and territories for ES, teachers and school leaders. For the AEU, this means closing the percentage gap between Victorian wages and those of public education workers in New South Wales in 2026, with further strong increases in subsequent years. As a result, the AEU Victorian Branch Executive, which is made up of elected AEU members who are practicing teachers, education support staff, and principals, along with the union's leadership, has resolved to suspend the commencement of rolling stop work action of AEU members in Victorian public schools for a 2-week period, enabling intensive negotiations to occur to maximise the best chance for an in-principle agreement to be reached. This means that the actions scheduled for this week and next week will not go ahead as previously advised. However, other industrial bans, including bans on answering Department of Education emails, provision of written comments in student reports for parents, and school visits by state Labor MPs, remain in place. It is through AEU members campaigning that we are closer to reaching an in-principle Victorian Government Schools Agreement. Back to you, Jean.
Well, we wouldn't have schools, would we? We wouldn't have public or private schools without teachers. And here is an interesting article from The Educator, Why Listening to Teachers Matters.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Naomi Nicholas from The Educator, Why Listening to Teachers Matters More Than Ever. In November 2025, educators, funders, and sector leaders gathered in Sydney for The Reality of Teaching, Insights from Australia's Educators, a conversation grounded in lived experience and honest reflection. Hosted by Primary Ethics in partnerships with cool.org and supported by the Waratah Education Foundation, the event created space for teachers to speak candidly about the realities of teaching in Australia today. At a time when schools are navigating rising workloads, growing youth wellbeing concerns, and constant change, the discussion centred the voices of educators working at the front line. The panel consisted of very experienced and passionate educators, including Alex Wharton from a rural New South Wales government school, Samira Gashi from a Victorian FLO school, and Tana Harding, proud Bayel and Kanaka woman, cool.org First Nation education lead and experienced secondary educator. What they shared was confronting, moving, and deeply instructive. Teachers are often described as the backbone of society, but at the Reality of Teaching event in Sydney, it became clear that they are much more than that. Teachers are counsellors, advocates, protectors, connectors, and in many cases, the last consistent adult in a young person's life. What they are carrying and what they are being asked to carry has fundamentally changed. This event brought together educators, service providers, and people working across the educational ecosystem with one shared purpose: to listen. Not to prescribe solutions from a distance, but to hear directly from teachers about the realities they face every day and what they need in order to keep showing up for children and young people. Teaching has changed, and the challenges are deeper than ever. Teachers spoke about how different the classroom feels compared to even a decade ago. Many are working with students experiencing complex mental health challenges, family instability, trauma, poverty, and disengagement from school that begins well before the school day starts. Inflexible learning and low socioeconomic settings, success is no longer measured by traditional academic milestones alone. Sometimes success looks like a student simply showing up. Sometimes it looks like sitting with a young person who arrives at school in tears, or creating a space where it is safe to feel, not just perform. Attendance is inconsistent. Class sizes fluctuate daily. Some students come for only a few hours. Others disappear for weeks at a time. Teachers must constantly adapt, redesign lessons on the spot, and meet students where they are emotionally, not just academically. Relationships are the foundation, but they come at a cost. Again and again, teachers return to the importance of relationships. Connection is what makes learning possible. Without it, literacy and numeracy simply do not land. Teachers described small moments that stay with them. A disengaged student lighting up when asked about motorbikes or mechanics. A quiet student who never speaks, leaving a heartfelt message in a card on World Teachers Day. A classroom coming together to grieve after the loss of a student to violent crime. These moments are why teachers stay, but they also take a toll. Unconditional positive regard, treating every child with care and respect no matter what they bring into the room, is powerful but exhausting. Many teachers spoke honestly about going home depleted, crashing emotionally, and struggling to find that same compassion for themselves. The system often undermines the very people it relies on. A recurring theme was the growing sense that teachers are not trusted as professionals. Constant reforms, new frameworks, shifting pedagogies, audits, and compliance requirements have left many feeling micromanaged and devalued. Teachers described the anxiety of being observed, judged, and measured against narrow indicators while juggling the real human needs of students in front of them. Unlike other professions, teaching is subject to intense public scrutiny, media narratives, and political intervention, often without meaningful consultation. There was a deep frustration about the disconnect between policy decisions and classroom reality. Teachers asked, where is the evidence behind these reforms? Where are the voices of educators in shaping them? Why are we treated as implementers of change rather than experts in our own practice? Leadership, support, and well-being matter. The difference strong leadership makes was clear. Teachers who felt supported by principals spoke with gratitude and resilience. Those without that support described isolation and burnout. There was also recognition that schools cannot do this work alone. Teachers highlighted the urgent need for multidisciplinary support in schools, social workers, youth workers, mental health professionals, and family support services, particularly in flexible learning environments. Expecting teachers to meet every need, academic, emotional, social, and behavioural, without adequate resourcing is neither fair nor sustainable. Why teachers' voices must be at the centre. Perhaps the most powerful message from the event was this: real change starts by listening to teachers. Not token consultation, not one-off surveys, but ongoing, respectful engagement that recognises teachers as skilled professionals with deep insight into what children need to thrive. Teachers are not asking for praise alone. They are asking for trust, flexibility, investment, and systems that value relationships as much as outcomes. They are asking for time to collaborate, to learn from one another, and to participate in shaping the future of education. Despite everything, the commitment in the room was unmistakable. Teachers continue to show up, even when it's hard, even when they are tired, because they believe in young people and the power of education to change lives. If we want a prosperous, fair, and compassionate society, we must start by listening to those who are holding it together every day. Back to you, Jean.
Well, many thanks to both Andy and Dale for keeping us up to date with all of this latest information. But let's have a break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. because we've got some more interesting material. Jane Coe from Sydney is travelling the country promoting her latest book, and she's very concerned about the segregation of our children on so many lines. If they want a cohesive society, when we know the very simple thing they have to do is to put children in school together, but that's far too simple for our policymakers. And she's looking elsewhere, other countries. Unfortunately, people who get all upset about disadvantaged children and who think that equality is the main thing, and it is very important, forget that if you want to have equality of opportunity, you should have equal schools, that is, schools that are open. And if people want to charge fees or discriminate on the basis of religion or whatever, they should have to pay for it. But they've forgotten these very, very basic principles. However, Jane Coe has some very interesting things to say. Let's hear from Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article is by Jane Coe and is entitled, "Our Kids Are Segregated in Every Way Imaginable. We Should Look to Canada for a Solution." Over the last half century, we have created a system of publicly funded schools, both private and public, that is unique in the world. We have given the chronically underfunded public system all the responsibilities and expect it to accept every child, including the most disadvantaged and so most expensive to teach, while starving it of resources. We have given sometimes extravagantly overfunded private schools all the rights, including the right to isolate themselves from the toughest end of education. As a result, we now have one of the most segregated education systems in the OECD. In the decade to 2015, Australia had the second highest increase in concentration of disadvantaged students in disadvantaged schools, lagging only to the Czech Republic. And we are continuing to use public funding to increase that segregation. For those kids in the so-called good schools, results have at best flatlined. For those in what are rapidly becoming residualized schools, results have plummeted. And we haven't just segregated our kids along class lines. We have sliced and diced them every way that we can think of. We put girls with girls, boys with boys, though as I've suggested, that might be changing a little. Smart kids with smart kids with rich kids, poor kids with poor kids with Christian kids, Muslim kids with Muslim kids Jewish kids, Catholic kids with, oh wait, I'm not so sure most kids in Catholic schools are very Catholic anymore. Sporty kids with sporty kids, arty kids with arty kids with black kids, and white kids with white kids. Is this a good idea? Will it build a cohesive society? Does it help our kids to get to know one another and help break down prejudice? Or does it do the opposite? I keep wondering what exactly the decades of parental choice, neoliberal, competition-driven education policies have gained Australia. Fees have not become more affordable, particularly at the so-called elite schools. And as high fees have increased financial hardship, so choice has increased anxiety and stress. If we think it's bad now, one expert has calculated that on the current trajectory, some private schools may be charging fees of $100,000 a year by 2036. I have asked defenders of public funding of private schools why they support our current system, even debated them on the odd occasion. Rarely do they claim anything that adds to the public good. They never cite improvements in excellence or equity. Instead, I always receive the same answers. It's always more about their right to get the taxpayer to subsidise their private and positional choices than anything else. The most common justification is that private school parents pay taxes, so their child is entitled to be subsidised. The child is subsidised, like any other child, via their entitlement to a fully, publicly funded place in their local public school. Even better, this entitlement continues, whether they choose to access the place or not. If they should lose their capacity to pay private school fees, their child is unhappy at the private school, or the private school is unhappy with their child, the local public school will accept them, no questions asked. The same is not true in reverse. The fact that a family decides not to take up their public school place is not a justification for the funding to transfer to a different school. Taxation is not a deposit account that we can draw on to buy whatever service we choose. Childless taxpayers also fund schools. According to the taxpayer argument, they should be able to withdraw that money. Our taxes fund public transport, but just because someone chooses not to catch a train or a bus, we don't believe their choice of a private car should be subsidised by the taxpayer. Another common justification is that sending a child to a private school helps public schools by reducing the burden of compulsory education. In fact, as I have argued more than once, the opposite is true. By removing the students requiring less support, private schools reduce the economy of scale in public schools. In other words, every middle-class kid who leaves the public system increases the ratio of needier students, thereby increasing the per-student cost. If most kids went to public schools, education would be cheaper for everyone, including governments, and much fairer. Finally, there is the argument that public funding puts downward pressure on fees. There is precisely no evidence that this has occurred, rather the opposite. Meanwhile, the proportion of disadvantaged students attending independent schools has shrunk dramatically. Hence the alarming synchronicity of 28.9% of students in private schools being from the highest socioeconomic backgrounds, while exactly 28.9% of the enrollment in public schools come from the lowest. So how do we wind back the damage we have done? Particularly as so few people want to recognise it even exists. I think Australia is as blind to the damage we are doing to our nation via the social segregation of our schools as America is to the horrific toll its refusal to implement sensible gun controls takes on its society. Tragically, those who suffer most in both instances are our children. There are solutions. The Gonski Review was an attempt to make our system fairer, and its recommendations might have had a positive effect if politics and vested interests had not got involved. Those who care about public education, both as a principle and as an indispensable part of our democracy, must be prepared for the powerful and the privileged to do all they can to head off any changes. The first suggestion about making our schooling systems more equal is, I believe, also the most politically achievable. It is something that has been suggested by many people, including participants in a national symposium on funding, equity and achievement in Australian schools, all of whom believe that all schools intercept of public money be subject to the same obligations. In other words, all publicly funded schools should have to abide by the same standards of compliance, implementation, and accountability for enrollment, behaviour, and inclusion. This seems reasonable and logical, especially as many private schools now receive as much, if not more, public funding per student than the similar public school down the road. In practice, this would mean that private schools, once they had enrolled a student, would not be able to exclude that student for any reason that differs from the standard required from a public school to do the same. Perhaps even exclusion because of the non-payment of fees should be subject to negotiation and arbitration by a body such as the Department of Education. This would prevent children that private schools decide they don't want from being dumped on the already underfunded nearby public school, thereby compounding their degree of difficulty. It would also require publicly funded private schools to shoulder at least some of the responsibility for compulsory education. As such, it is an eminently arguable proposition. Why should some schools in receipt of public funding have obligations to the public good while others have none? The current education funding reforms meant to bring every school up to its SRS, Schooling Resource Standard, will not kick in fully until 2034. Worse, they may still not be fully funded even then, given the definition of fully funded is disputed. Education researchers Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner, in their book Waiting for Gonski, take this idea a step further. They suggest that all schools should be offered the chance of being publicly funded as long as they agree not to charge fees. They could keep their special character, usually religious, but would have to accept all children who wanted to attend within their area. Some private schools, especially high fee ones, might decide this was a bridge too far and decline the offer, in which case they would lose their public funding and be self-supporting. This would then release some badly needed dollars for schools struggling with a high concentration of disadvantage. Greenwell and Bonner call this the Ontario solution, as that's what schools in the Canadian province have done. Chris Bonner told me about the shock the Catholic bishops of Ontario expressed when it was suggested that their schools could charge fees. They saw it as utterly antithetical to their religious mission. Maybe they should come and have a chat with the Catholic bishops in this country. In both the United Kingdom and New Zealand, the majority of religious schools are part of the public system. They do not charge fees, must accept all local kids who want to come, but may keep their religious character. The only problem with this suggestion is that the private schools will fight it. And that matters because they are exceptionally powerful lobbyists. And they can have their cake and eat it now. They will probably fight to the death against any attempt to rebalance the scales. And that was an edited extract from Jane Caro's new book, Rich Kid, Poor Kid, The Battle for Public Education. Back over to you, Jane.
Well, thank you so very much, Sorrel, and thanks to Jane Caro, who keeps fighting for children in public schools. Andrew Lay from the Labor Party in Canberra is a very interesting character. He's written a number of very interesting books, and he is an economist. And he wants to talk about social mobility being the key to Australian growth. Well, we know that the key to social mobility, of course, is educational opportunity. But let's hear from him, shall we, to see what he has to say about the latest research about Australian social cohesion and social mobility.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Andrew Lee from the Saturday paper. New research challenges the narrative of this country as classless, highlighting the importance of enabling children to realise their full potential. Social mobility is key to Australian growth. Quality of education is key to social mobility. In My Brilliant Career, Miles Franklin gave Australia a portrait of a frustrated talent in the figure of Sybilla Melvin. Sybilla is intelligent, ambitious, restless, and painfully aware of the narrow world around her. She knows she has ability, and she can see how few doors are open to a girl in her position. Her family's fortunes are sliding, money is scarce, and marriage to a wealthier man is held out as the respectable route upwards. She refuses it. The book's title is ironic. This is not the story of a brilliant career fulfilled, but of one blocked at the outset. More than a century on, we still argue about the same questions in different language. How tightly should a person's future be tethered to their parents' income, their suburb, their school, or the people they happen to know? How much should a child predict? As a politician, I see that as a question of fairness. As an economist, I see it as a question of efficiency. A country is less productive when it does a poor job of finding talent, nurturing talent, and deploying talent. Social mobility is not only about justice between citizens, it is also about whether we are making full use of the abilities of our own people. That matters because talent is common, opportunity is not. Australians like to tell themselves a flattering story. We are not aristocratic, we say. We are not a society of fixed ranks. We are a place where a child from modest beginnings can make something of themselves. There is enough truth in that story to keep it alive, but we could do better. Australia performs respectably by international standards on intergenerational mobility. The latest research suggests that, compared with many advanced countries, the link between parents' earnings and the children's later earnings is weaker here. That's encouraging, but it doesn't mean we can relax. In a recent Australian study, Thomas Kennedy and Peter Siminski found that absolute mobility, the simple question of whether children out-earn their parents, has slipped over time. More than 80% of baby boomers earned more than their parents at a comparable age. For Australians born in the 70s and early 80s, that figure is closer to two-thirds. Some of that reflects slower growth, some reflects wider inequality. Both make it harder for a country to keep faith in the promise that each generation will have a broader horizon than the one before. A country that makes better use of the abilities of its people will usually be fairer. It will also usually be richer. Economists once told themselves the story that we didn't need to worry much about inequality because society was so mobile. It did not matter much if some started high and others low, so long as children could move easily up and down the ladder. As economists have gathered better data, however, the research tells a harsher story. Countries with greater inequality tend also to have less mobility. As the rungs of the ladder stretch further apart, it becomes harder to climb up or down. Summing up his team's findings, US economist Raj Chetty notes, "Your chances of achieving the American dream are almost two times higher if you are growing up in Canada than in the United States." Australia is more mobile and more egalitarian than the US, but we still have plenty of room to improve. Boosting mobility isn't just good for fairness, it can also lift the productivity of the economy. Economists are used to thinking about misallocation across companies and industries. We worry when capital is trapped in weak businesses or when workers are stuck in jobs that make poor use of their skills. Social mobility asks us to think about misallocation across lives. How much ability lies dormant because a child grew up in unstable housing, poor health, or a neighbourhood cut off from jobs and useful networks? In an economy increasingly shaped by ideas, engagement, skill and judgment, it's vital that we encourage talent to flourish. Just as professional sporting teams benefit from youth feeder leagues and talent scouts, economies succeed when they seek out ability in unexpected places. A society that draws its inventors, entrepreneurs, managers and professionals from too narrow a slice of the population is leaving productive capacity idle. The evidence on innovation is particularly strong. US research shows that children from the richest 1% of families are 10 times more likely to become inventors than children from below median households, even when you compare children with similar maths performance in early life. The problem is not a shortage of inventive ability. The problem is that some children are much more likely to encounter the classrooms, mentors, institutions, and expectations that turn ability into achievement. Australia has its own version of that story. The latest Startup Muster survey on new climate technology suggests that only about 1 in 9 founders come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. We might think of those who miss out as lost Fiona Woods and Elizabeth Blackburns. Children with native ability to transform burns medicine or molecular biology, whose paths never crossed the teachers or mentors that would have let that ability flower. That's not just a gross inequity, it's a productivity loss. Mobility can no longer be confined to academic debates among philosophers, sociologists, and economists. The newer research looking at health, place, peers, and connection has direct policy implications. Consider neighbourhoods. Australian work using de-identified tax data has examined more than 300,000 cases of families moving during childhood. Researcher Nathan Deutscher finds that where a child grows up has a lasting effect on adult outcomes, including income and education. Timing matters too. Moving earlier tends to have larger effects than moving later. Opportunity, in other words, is rooted in streets, schools, sporting clubs, public transport links, and local expectations. This should shift the way we think about housing. Housing is not only critical for well-being and wealth. In many cases, the property market also decides who gets access to high-opportunity neighbourhoods. It decides which children are near stronger schools, safer streets, better services, and richer social networks. The cost of a home is becoming the fee charged for entry to a better life. In the first two decades of the 21st century, Australia failed to build enough homes. The result was higher rents, higher prices, and a tighter grip of inherited advantage, stored in land and passed on. Building more homes eases pressure on buyers and renters, makes it easier for workers to live near where the jobs are, and creates more opportunities for children. The same goes for early childhood and health. If a child arrives at school with a chronic illness or untreated trauma, they are already carrying a heavier load than their classmates. That has consequences for fairness and for the shape of the labour force two decades later. The making of a productive economy starts well before the first pay packet. It begins in homes, clinics, preschools, and playgrounds. This is not to deny personal agency. People do overcome bleak odds. Australia has no shortage of such stories. But public policy should not be built on heroic exceptions. The task is not to admire those who scramble over the wall. It is to ask why the wall is there in the first place and how to bring it down. There's an old tendency in public debate to separate growth from fairness, as though one belongs to hard-headed economists and the other to soft-hearted idealists. Social mobility exposes the falsity of that divide. A country that makes better use of the abilities of its people will usually be fairer. It will also usually be richer. Mobility is important for economic policy because wasted ability is an economic failure. The title of My Brilliant Career still carries a warning. Australia has no shortage of talent or ambition. The challenge is to open more doors in more suburbs for more children. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. It's always interesting, and the dogs do try to keep everybody informed about what policymakers are thinking about the social cohesion question and education. But now our roving expert, and this is Jeff, is going to take us overseas.
Good afternoon, listeners. Sensitive topic today. We're going to look at militarism in schools. Now, the dogs doesn't take sides with any particular group, but there's a lot of trouble in the world at the moment. So it's just a fact that sometimes our stories will touch on issues that are going on overseas in conflicts. This week we're not going to walk away from that. We're going to look at Russian schools and some schools in Canada. Both of these school stories involve the role of militarising children. So the dogs is always on the side of the children, not on the side of any one or side or the other. We may have our personal ideas, but the dogs is just about the kids and public education. First article, these are always going to be controversial. So this article comes from United 24 Media, which is a publication from Ukraine, and therefore you must take it on board as a with a grain of salt because it's about Russian schools. So obviously Ukraine is at war with Russia Russia has invaded Ukraine. So this article by Cyril Baraboltchuk, Russian schools warn students of life in prison for treason and the dangers of VPNs. School children across Russia are attending special classes where they are warned about prison sentences, including life imprisonment, for actions classified as state treason, espionage and sabotage, the Moscow Times reported on April 29. Lessons, titled Treason Against the Motherland is the Gravest Crime, were held in April for students in grades 5 through 11 across dozens of schools and technical colleges in regions ranging from Tatarstan to Yamalo-Nenets Autonomous Region. The lectures feature speakers from the Prosecutor's Office, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the Investigative Committee, as well as lawyers and representatives of the Zanani Society. Students are taught about the consequences of defecting to the enemy and are told that traitors have never been forgiven throughout Russian history. In the Amur region, lecturers emphasise that the consequences of sabotage, terrorism or espionage include life imprisonment and the formation of a heavily negative public reputation for the perpetrators. During the classes, students are explicitly urged to show civic vigilance and report any suspicious activities to security forces. Lecturers warn that treason not only results in lengthy prison terms, but also destroys the lives and reputations of both the guilty individuals and their relatives. Alongside these warnings, students are instructed on how to avoid online recruitment, the importance of patriotism and the supposed feats of the Russian military on the front line in Ukraine, the Moscow Times reported. Additionally, schools are currently conducting lessons to warn children about the legal dangers of using VPN services to bypass internet restrictions. These classes feature titles such as Using a VPN is an Aggravating Circumstance When Committing War Crimes, and VPNs Are Outlawed. To deliver these warnings, educational institutions are bringing in police officers, psychiatrists, and employees of the Federal Prison Service. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Russian authorities have restricted internet access by blocking Western social media platforms and independent news websites. To enforce these measures, the government implemented a ban on the promotion of VPN services in 2024 and has increasingly targeted the technical infrastructure used to bypass state-imposed filters. These mandatory security classes are part of a Russian state effort to integrate military and state narratives into the education system. According to a previous report, authorities in Moscow ordered educational institutions to establish museums dedicated to the invasion of Ukraine, with 175 already set up across the city. The initiative, which follows a 2023 directive from Russian leader Vladimir Putin, features frontline artifacts and installations. This also extends to early childhood education, with kindergartens being recommended to create similar exhibits to foster patriotism and involve families in volunteer activities supporting the military. That's the end of the article. As terrible echoes of history in Germany in the 1930s. Right, now we're going to go to another article, which is involving militarising schools. This article came from the Jerusalem Post, but it's about Canada, and it's written by Matilda Heller. Canadian Jewish schools hit with CRA complaint over alleged support for Israeli military. A CRA complaint accuses 11 Jewish schools of aiding foreign military recruitment and violating charity rules. A group of pro-Palestinian organisations has filed a complaint with the Canada Revenue Agency, accusing 11 Jewish schools of promoting the Israeli military and potentially aiding and abetting illegal military recruiting. The complaint was submitted on April 22, 26 by Palestinian and Jewish Unity, Ontario Palestinian Rights Association, Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, and Just Peace Advocates. The organisations are essentially formally asking the tax regulator to investigate whether a registered charity or non-profit has broken Canadian charity and tax rules. Given that many private schools are registered charities, the complaint is asking the CRA to examine whether those schools' activities are consistent with the rules required to keep charitable status. It comes just months after the Maples' David Matracci, who formally released the Find IDF Soldiers project, unveiled his new project called GTA to IDF, which doxes institutions that Canadian-Israeli soldiers attended and their involvement with them. The aim of the GTA to IDF is to highlight what role Canadian institutions may play in promoting Israel and the IDF. The complaint also comes 2 months after the influential French-language Canadian paper La Presse published an article about publicly subsidised Jewish private schools in Montreal hosting active or former Israeli soldiers as speakers. Parents at the time told the Jerusalem Post that they were appalled at the newspaper for allowing a so-called journalist to publish an article which puts students attending the school at risk. The pro-Palestinian groups alleged that the 11 schools supported for Israel is a contravention of the CRA's rules for registered charities, which state increasing the effectiveness and efficacy of Canada's armed forces is charitable, but supporting the armed forces of another country is not. They also cited the Foreign Enlistment Act, which says that recruiting or inducing any person or body of persons to enlist or accept any commission in a foreign military is illegal. The 11 schools are Associated Hebrew Schools of Toronto, B'nai Akiva Schools of Toronto, Bass Toronto, Toronto Herschel School, Neviot Torah Day School, Tannenbaum Chat Bialik Hebrew Day School, Leo Baik Day School, Bialik High School, Herzliya High School, and Hebrew Academy. The complaint also targets any donors who gave more than $5 million to one or more of the associated schools. Unsurprisingly, the complaint leans heavily on the information provided on the Maples GTA to IDF database. GTA to IDF, for example, wrote that AHS twins with Israel schools, enabling peer-to-peer relationships and joint projects like bridge-building competitions and visits from Israeli delegations. The school's online accounts also praise IDF soldiers, and the school brings soldiers in to speak to students. These groups then revealed the top donors to the schools and how much they gave. This process was repeated for all the other schools, listing the alleged promotion of Israel's military and then the top 10 donors. Religious Zionist culture is portrayed negatively, as are any fundraisers for Israel in any way. The groups then said that according to both domestic and international law, the CRA has the responsibility to ensure Canadian taxpayers are not subsidising war crimes or assisting the aiding and abetting of recruiting for a foreign military. With the report that 1,500 Canadians are serving in the Israeli military, and given the age of joining the military in most cases is shortly after the end of high school, this is indeed a serious concern. It's even more serious if Canadian taxpayers are subsidising the illegal recruiting of these individuals through charity tax breaks. This taxpayer contribution is supporting individuals who serve in a military committing war crimes and genocide, making the individuals plausibly guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. That was a quote from the article that this post is quoting. Earlier this year, some of the same groups took aim at Jewish summer camps for their explicit support for Israeli military and genocide. When children's camps support a genocidal state, it's time for a gigantic change. The groups, including Canada BDS, wrote in a short joint statement in February. The groups claim to have identified at least 17 summer camps throughout Canada that support the State of Israel in some way. Of the 17, 10 are in Ontario, 3 in Quebec, and one each in Alberta, British Columbia, Manitoba and Nova Scotia. It's worth noting that one of the individuals on the Just Peace Advocates Board of Directors is Jonathan Kutab, the co-founder of Al-Haq. Al-Haq is a designated terror organisation in Israel and is sanctioned by the US for directly engaging in efforts by the International Criminal Court to investigate, arrest, detain or prosecute Israeli nationals without Israel's consent. On Tuesday, B'nai B'rith Canada said it is demanding that the CRA dismiss the unfounded, bigoted complaint raised against Jewish schools in Toronto and Montreal. This is not an isolated issue or campaign, said Simon Waller, B'nai B'rith Canada's chief executive officer. It's a coordinated and malicious attack on Jewish life, extending from sector to sector and charity to charity. Waller added that thousands of Jewish families rely on these schools and camps, and thus the deceitful movement has already caused considerable alarm and concern in the Jewish community. Richard Robertson, B'nai B'rith Canada's Director of Research and Advocacy, said the campaign is attempting to weaponise Canadian charity law as part of a concerted effort to villainise Jewish institutions. The Centre for Israel and Jewish Affairs, the UJA Federation and Federation CJA, then released a joint statement condemning what they referred to as a coordinated campaign to erase Jewish life in Canada. For months, a veritable witch hunt across various channels has targeted all Jewish community institutions with the goal of erasing Jewish life in this country. Today, this campaign, orchestrated by radical anti-Jewish and anti-Israeli groups, has crossed a new threshold by attacking our community schools with a clear and blatant intent to weaponise the Canada Revenue Agency, the CRA. The goal is not transparency, but a blatant desire to paralyse and destroy Jewish community life in Canada. Targeting our schools means targeting our children, and that is unacceptable. That's the end of the article. So, in effect, it's a Jewish article which is highlighting what they say is a campaign against them, which causes hate crimes against Jewish people in Canada. And the other side is saying that, well, they're using their Jewish schools to promote militarism and recruitment for the IDF. So, look, I don't know who's right and who's wrong in all these things, but I'm just saying that this militarizing of children in Russia and Israel, at least the stories that purport to be reporting these things, are concerning, and I don't like the idea of our children being militarized at all by anybody. So, with that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of dogs. Cheerio.
Well, thank you so very much, Jeff. Let's have a break, shall we, and come back to some good news.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still with us here at the Dogs, because this is our final best news story. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Cranbourne West Primary School. Cranbourne West Primary School welcomes you to our website. Unconditional positive regard for everyone. All state schools are great schools. Principals, welcome. Welcome to our school. We are fortunate because we are a well-established school and we have learned what is important for you and your children. We live our values of respect, trust, sense of humour, and most of all, learning. When you enrol at our school, you'll be provided with lots of information around our expectations and what we do. One of the most important documents is our values booklet, because that provides you with the behaviours we expect from our school community, parents, children, and staff to show at all times. We have achieved significant student learning growth outcomes over the last 5 years. We expect that all children will achieve at least 12 months in their learning every year. Our teachers and support staff work really hard to make sure we maintain the growth in your children's learning. Our results have reflected this laser-like focus on your children's learning. Most of all, though, we want your children to be happy and content with their schooling, because they learn so much more effectively when they like coming to school. All children learn differently. Part of the skill of our teachers is to recognise this and to tailor their teaching style to maximise your child's learning. This is the reason why we spend time with you and your family to find out about your child while you are enrolling. In this way, we are well prepared to ensure your child has a great start to their time at Cranbourne West Primary School. School values. Cranbourne West Primary School's values are learn, trust, respect, and sense of humour. Learn. We learn when we are organised and ready to learn in a classroom that is engaging and focused. Trust. We trust that all people in the school have the best interests of students as a priority and that everyone is always kind, courteous, and considerate of others in the school. Respect. We respect ourselves and each other and understand that our attitudes and behaviours have an impact on the people around us. Sense of humour. Our sense of humour allows us to see the humour in difficult situations and teaches us to laugh with and not at others. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The school has 594 students and the ICSEA value of the school is 946. 4% of students are in the top 25% of socio-educational advantage, 14% in the second quartile, 27% in the third quartile of SEA, and 55% in the lowest 25% of socio-educational advantage. 54% of students have a language background other than English, and 3% are Indigenous. It costs the taxpayer $19,606 to educate a student at this school for a year. The school receives $2.24 million from the federal government and $8.6 million from the state government, $143,777 from fees, charges and parent contributions, and $183,000 from other private sources. There's been $1.3 million in capital grants for the last 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Cranbourne West Primary School. I did like the bit about their values include humour. But our time is gone. We'd like to remind you that Radiothon is coming up and the dogs have got to raise almost $5,000 again. It's time now to remind you of this, but also to say goodbye from 3CR.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station.
Call 03-9419 8377 or sign up online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast.
3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.